Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we review Zendaya's new film, Challengers, and introduce a brand new game.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 308 of Real Blend, a podcast that wants to take a deep breath through our foreheads. I'm cleaning that up, Ryan Reynolds. Going to leave that F-bomb out. On this week's show, Zendaya is back in theaters with a brand new film called Challengers. We're going to give our reviews. We're going to dip into some spoilers. And we're going to discuss the Deadpool and Wolverine trailer that dropped earlier this week. So stay tuned. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast alongside Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., who, if you're watching on YouTube, has a beautiful background reflected over his shoulder. Looks really nice in the DMV today. Kev, how are you?
The weather is stunningly beautiful. Just driving into work this morning, it just, like, I don't know. There's something, you guys know how it is. Like, I weirdly like a good overcast rainy day, but I also get a refreshing feeling of, like, an uplifting feeling when it's nicer out. I just don't want it to be super hot. I am not a beach type of person. I'm a fall spring guy, but I like this. This is good.
You know what I can't be? I can't be one of those people who lives in a place that doesn't have seasons. I legitimately need to through all four seasons.
Thank you. That's why I could never live in LA. Everyone always asks me, like, when are you moving to LA? I'm like, no, and as much as I love LA, I love visiting LA, but there is nothing. And again, it gets very hot here on the East Coast. Sean and I know that, but it's
humid,
but I do like seasons. I like transitioning into different outfits, different coats, different, you know, things. Sure. I don't know. I like that feeling of it, you know?
Well, and I anticipate the next season as one is ending. Like, I'm sick of winter. I'm ready for spring. Spring is fine. When it gets to summer, and as you say, it's just brutally hot, then I'm ready for fall. I'm ready for it to cool off a bit and college. Like, I couldn't imagine doing college football in the NFL and stuff like that when it's 85, 90 degrees outside. That would make no sense to me.
Food and drinks too. Like, I think, like, I like to transition to different foods and drinks while I'm in different seasons. Anyways, 100%. This is our new food and beverage show right here.
Welcome to Real Blend. Pumpkin Spice Blend. And filling in for Jake Hamilton is our wonderful producer and friend of the show, Gabe Kovach. Hey, Gabe, how are you doing?
I am good. Pleasure to see you, boys. I'll chime in. I think that the best sort of calendar of seasons is if the super hot temperature lasts about a month and the super cold temperature lasts about a month, and then fall and spring or everything else, that would be perfect.
Yep. I'm okay with that.
I agree.
I've written off January as a month. Like, they're just nothing great happens in January. No offense if you have a birthday or anything like that during January, but, like, I just need to get to February to feel like I'm closer to spring.
You know who has a birthday in February or January?
The Jake.
Jake Hamilton.
He's dead to
us. January 18th. The only reason I remember his birthday.
He's dead to us.
I could be wrong, but growing up, one of my favorite bands was Korn. And the lead singer of that band's birthday, I think, is Jonathan Davis. I think it's January 18th. And I always remember Jake's because of that. Always.
And Kevin always wishes him happy birthday before he wishes Jake a happy birthday.
I do. Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever seen the two of them in the same room.
I always send Jonathan a corn on the cob for his birthday. He loves it. Yeah, he loves it.
All right. On that note, if you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Thank you very much for joining us. Give us a like and a subscribe. Hit the comments down below. Let us know where you're listening from. And as always, keep the conversations very civil down in the comments as you guys talk about movies and friendship and all of that amazing stuff. If you're listening to us in the audio format, we're at youtube.com/realblendpodcast. Of course, available all the different places your podcast needs are met. If you'd like to sign up for Real Blend Premium, the service gets you an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter from me, usually on Fridays, sometimes on Mondays, as was the case this week. Check the description for information on where you can sign up. So we've been having an interesting conversation on the show lately about the more indie-esque type films that have been coming to the theaters, meaning non-IP, non-franchise type things. Abigail, Civil War, some of the stuff director driven. And now Challengers is coming out. And I'm curious genuinely how it's going to do with the box office, because for this reason, I feel like, and I've been making this case over the course of this year, dipping into last year, that this now feels like we're coming back around. I'm not sure if I've said this on the show or if I've just been saying this out loud. It feels like we're getting back into an era where people are coming to projects because of movie stars. And not necessarily because of the, I'm not saying that IP stuff isn't doing well and it's always going to attract people. And as we get into the summer months, you're going to see Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and you're going to see Deadpool and Wolverine. Of course, they're going to pull out the audience members. But Civil War, you know, getting attention because of Kirsten Dunst being in the lead. Challengers getting attention because of Zendaya. I even argue when we get to Fall Guy and we talk about that, that that's going to be a project that's largely driven on the chemistry between Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. And to the point where if Jake were here, I'd give him hell for this, you know, him not knowing that it was based on a television series, like kind of assuming that the idea of the Fall Guy was an original concept, which I think is great. Like, I think we needed to sort of pull back a bit from the industry's reliance on brands, you know, and again, we're not going to get completely away from it. There's still a safety net of that. But I feel like we hopefully will start to see more projects like a Challengers, which maybe doesn't cost, you know, more than the $50-60 million range, doesn't have to earn back $250 million to break even.
Right.
And can lean on the hopefully growing audiences of a lead performer like Zendaya who want to come out and see her in something completely different. So I'm going to be curious to pay attention to the box office performance of this. I haven't yet seen it. Michelle and I are going to go see it this weekend. Luckily, both Gabe and Kevin got a chance to see Challengers before we reviewed it. And I want them to sort of dive into how it is.
I just have a quick point about your box office thing. I saw a tweet the other day. I don't know who to give credit to for this, but a lot of mid-budget films are doing very well now. Like in terms of like we were seeing so many films for a long time that were spending $200 million or whatever. And these, you know, these were superhero films like you mentioned. But I want to point out a few films. One of the films I saw in that tweet was about The Beekeeper, for example. The Beekeeper had like a $40 million budget from what I understand. It made $152 million worldwide. Anyone But You cost reportedly $25 million or so and made $219 million worldwide. And you could make an argument that The Beekeeper made what it made because Statham has a name. He's great in that action genre. You know, and so you make a film mid-budget and then you make a lot of money off of it. Anyone But You is a great example of the star power of Sydney Sweeney and coming off the heels of Top Gun with Glenn Powell. And I think you're right. I think we got away from that whole idea of a movie star. I think, though, this younger generation of movie stars, I'm really impressed with the Austin Butlers, the Timothy Chalamets, the Zendayas. These are actors who are extremely talented. They're interested in the process. They're very familiar with filmmaking and they're wanting to make good choices. And Austin Butler, to me, is one of those fascinating guys who could be like the next DiCaprio or Chalamet. And I think there's a lot to be said there about that. Civil War is a great example as well. A mid-budget film that's actually doing very well. The highest grossing, you know, opening ever for A24, as you said, with Kirsten Dunst leading it. It's like a big deal that she can have a movie come out in this day and age. Not just her, but any actor like Statham, for example. Statham could have fallen wayside to the whole idea of like IP and these big superhero movies, but the brand of Statham and the brand of someone like Kirsten Dunst, who's just an incredible actor, give her a good vehicle to show again how amazing she really is. Not that she ever fell off, but she is just an extraordinary talent. And when given the right material, or when you put someone in the right material, you give them ability to shine. You don't have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think Oppenheimer was another great example of that as well. Not a mid-budget film, but a $100 million movie that made almost $1 billion. I think I don't know if you saw the Seinfeld quote recently where he talked about the idea of the movie business kind of being over. I don't want to misquote him, but he talked about... Yeah, and it was kind of like the idea of... I saw it on Deadline. It was kind of like the idea that like back in the day, one movie would come out, everyone would go see it, everyone would talk about it. And I think what he's trying to say is that there's just too much material now to consume. It's like, to me, it's like opening the Cheesecake Factory menu And I'm like, what the hell do I order? There's just too much stuff there. And because of all the streaming platforms and all these things, there's really no singular way now for people to experience something and on a singular level communally and talk about it at all. And I do think that once we kind of hit a breaking point where it's too much for audiences to kind of know, do I go to Hulu? Do I go to Prime? Do I go to Disney Plus? Do I go to the theaters? Do I do this? Is it on demand? Once I think we get a little more consolidated, I think that will come back. And I think we're seeing that kind of with what your point is about the idea of the movie star now becoming the attraction again and bringing people back to the theaters. And then the most talked about things, Barbie, Oppenheimer, things like that.
I think it's also worth mentioning, though, it feels like a natural conclusion of we were and still are to a point in this period where production budgets and marketing budgets were both inflating at the same time. The overall cost of a film, a theatrical release, was exponentially larger. And I think at that scale, the idea that the movie star was bringing enough to cover both of that was pretty insignificant. But if you lower those budgets, and I would be curious if we get more transparency on marketing budgets, because a $50 million movie, I'm curious, is that a $100 million, you know, marketing budget? Are they still dumping $200? You know, like what is that cost? But if you lower that budget down, the power of that star to bring in $100 million looks a lot better against a $50 million budget versus, you know, $150, $300. So I think us sort of reaching a point where I would call it smarter decisions are being made. And you know, they're not just making the most expensive thing because that seems, quote unquote, seems to be what works, I think is going to make all of that work a little bit more seamlessly.
And to your point, I'm actually curious, with budget inflations and marketing inflations, how much social media factors into it. I remember there was a story a couple of years ago where they were like, didn't Rock have $1 million addition to his contract for posting on social media of some sort movie that he's promoting? Yeah. And so if you're Zendaya and you have 240 million Instagram followers, if I'm MGM, Amazon, the studio putting out Challengers, maybe you give Zendaya an extra $1 million and she promises five or six or seven posts. She's a producer on the movie.
I was going to say, she's a producer. Like, it would behoove her anyway. Like, I assume 100%. As a producer and as the star, she's going to have some sort of back end. Like, even if you just go as far as making the box office incentive for the stars, giving them a reason, you know, whether it's paying out $1 million or not, giving them an incentive to promote the movie, which sounds kind of obvious, I think is beneficial.
One more quick thing, though, think about it like this. If you're a movie studio and let's say you have like a $40 million marketing budget for your film and $20 million of that is going to be TV ad spends. But why spend it? Why spend $20 million on TV ad spends when less people are watching cable? And you know that a video on Instagram or Twitter or TikTok by that star could get upwards of 10, 20, 30, 40 million eyeballs on it.
Right. And so, the question, though, is, I mean, the raw numbers are the raw numbers, but I think that there's also something to be said to the metric of like mobilization. Like, what does a 30 second TV slot in the middle of a very popular show on cable
or a game,
what does that do? What attention does that have, and how far does that mobilize that audience versus someone, you know, and sort of the noise of a social media network kind of seeing it in passing? Sure, maybe that's 4 million people saw this thing in the first 20 minutes. But does that mean that 4 million of them even know they saw it or kind of they're incentivized to see it? Like how effective is that type of marketing versus that, I think, is also a question that has to be answered by, again, these large marketing departments that studios now have. That's not just as simple as I think is like Apple. It's more of an apples to oranges than sort of a one to one comparison, potentially.
I do want to read Seinfeld's quote because I do find it pretty interesting in the sense that
what's the deal with theaters?
What's the deal? he said, film doesn't occupy the pinnacle in the social cultural hierarchy that it did for most of our lives. When a movie came out, if it was good, we all went to see it. We all discussed it. We quoted lines and scenes that we liked. Now we're walking through a fire hose of water just trying to see. Now, there's an element of old man yells at the cloud to that. But there's an element of it, of that's the reality. That is the reality.
But
the
last audience summer has changed. Disproves that. Last summer disproves that, though.
Well, yes, but I think last summer we paid a lot of attention to those two films breaking through into the cultural zeitgeist because so many movies don't anymore.
Right.
Or not with the frequency that they used to. Like, yes, the mainstream casual moviegoer usually knew what the big July 4th movie was. You know, they usually knew what tentpole was on its way. And I'm not quite sure that outside of the film bubble, and I'm not even saying the film Twitter bubble, but even just people who like going to the movies on the regular, I'm not quite sure that they pay as much attention to that as they used to. And maybe as they get closer to a movie like, say, Furiosa, they'll say like, oh, yeah, I saw that other Mad Max movie and I really liked it a lot. I'll go check that one out kind of thing. But I think it's harder for films like a Challengers to break through a lot of the noise that's out there, because I think there is a ton.
And I think you made this point. I don't know if it was on the show or you wrote about it, Sean, but I know you've talked about this before. I do think that the general audience is also approaching the theater more from a film lover's perspective, in the sense that I think they see value in seeing bigger, louder, more, whether it's action or just larger scale things in a theater versus making that decision at home. Like, I do think general audiences are able to make that determination where they would see maybe something like a Challengers that is, it seems like more of a straightforward drama, and say like, well, why do I need to go see that on a big screen? That could be really, I watch Netflix series all the time on my TV and they're compelling and they're great. I'll wait and watch that. Like, I think the general audience does balance that sort of, maybe not to the extent that Kevin talks about the film versus digital or the, you know, aspect ratio, but I do think that there's an inherent sort of taste in, like, is this worth me going? Is it gonna, it being loud and being big?
Well, let's remember too, the average moviegoer sees two movies a year, isn't that right?
Yeah, two to three. Yeah.
I mean, crazy. You think about that. That's a ridiculous statistic when you try to figure out what determines the three that they're going out of their way.
But even if
see.
That number, that also, you know, we talk about the fire hose analogy. Even if that number was statically the same, we were talking about movies gave each other space back then as far as the number of movies that were coming out. If everyone saw a couple things, if the variety was there for, you know, they saw these three things, they saw these three things, everything had a chance to do well. But every weekend we're getting, you know, two, three movies, and it's like, one of these is going to be seen by, you know, potentially.
Two other quick points. One thing I will say is this, and I said this yesterday on my show, like, when the pandemic happened, there were a lot bigger things to worry about than the movie industry. Of course, we all know that. Sure. But for movie theaters to have survived and be thriving post that time, to me, says something about the want and need of that communal experience and why people still go. The second thing to Jerry's quote, which I think is interesting, is we are in a very new age right now of the way we view content, social media, streaming apps, but the movie theater is still there. But like, one thing that I think we're still trying to figure out, and I think this is interesting, and then we can move on, is how streaming services are dropping their content. Because you look at Netflix, they drop all their episodes at once. Apple TV does week to week. Prime Video does all at once. Hulu does week to week. And there's an argument to be made about,
I think Prime,
for example,
does both. So your point is the same. So I think they switch depending on the series. I could be wrong.
But I'm glad you bring that up, because Prime dropped Fallout all at once. And I saw a quote from someone who was involved in that series saying, like, why would we drop this all at once? Why would you not keep a conversation going for 10 weeks? Like, my mom and dad, when they watched Hijack on Apple TV, they sat down every single week at the same time and watched it as an appointment show.
Consumers don't like that now, though. Some people really like the binge model, and they come... It happens no matter. There's no winning at this point. I think it's just, I don't know that even the show can dictate what's necessary. Sometimes a show could really benefit from a week to week, and sometimes a show could really benefit from one of the other.
But the marketing conversation.
But no matter what you do, there's always people that say, why can't I just binge this? I'm tired of waiting for the next thing. And then there's people that say, well, why do I have to binge this? I'm getting spoilers. I think that's such a split right now in what people prefer.
Well, I'll use us as an example. Michelle and I are finally catching up with The Bear. I've been telling the boys this. And we want to parcel it out. It's all the first two, the two seasons are available to us.
And that is a week to week show.
Is it really? Okay. That's interesting. Each night we kind of finish up dinner, clean up the kitchen. And then we look at each other and we go, you want to do two episodes? It's there. It's there. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe we're part of the problem. I'm not sure. Let me ask. Okay. So transition over to Challengers. I hate to say this, but it feels or it looks like to me a movie I could wait to see on on streaming when it comes out. Kev, tell me why I shouldn't.
I mean,
I'm going to push against
that. I can give you one reason not to.
Okay, I bet you have the same reason.
Is it Ross?
Is it the score? It's the score.
It's, okay. I mean, it's, I will, to just dip right into the review, and Sean hasn't seen this, we'll keep this like spoiler free, and then I think Kevin and I will dip into a little bit of spoilers because we want to talk about the conclusion of it. I will say this up top. I know that I'm the person that's like, if I had the choice, I would never know anything about a movie and I would just go into it. I very much enjoy watching movies that way. And this sounds obvious because all movies are, you know, they're edited to be seen in sequential order. Sure. This movie, the story is specifically structured. It is exquisite in the way that it is structured, where scene by scene, information is shown and revealed, and not like Cabin in the Woods type reveals, but dramatic reveals or bits of information are trickled to you scene by scene that change scenes before it and two scenes before it and three scenes before it to where the scene that you start with and the scene that you end with are technically, there's a scene that sort of is, the movie follows as it goes. And they're wildly different, even though they're kind of the same thing. And it's really brilliant. I recommend going in not knowing, knowing as little as possible. But the Reznor and Ross score is so effective in that it's a very dramatic, sort of straightforward drama. And it has, like, you know, the tennis is action in a sense. It's exciting and intense. But the way that they use Reznor and Ross's score is that a moment can seem kind of sullen or just sort of normal. And it's just, this is just a mid shot and it's just this person and they're feeling away. And then it hits and you go, this is electric. This scene goes from 0 to 60 with the needle drop of their score. And it is, it's kind of like an, Kevin, how would you describe it? I haven't seen it in, it's been a few weeks since I've seen it, but I think of it as like an electronic, almost EDM type, like rave heartbeat kind of feeling music.
So I asked Zendaya about this, because the question I asked Zendaya, which I found interesting, is I asked Tom Hanks this question a few years ago and I got a really interesting response, which is like, when an actor performs their role and then they finally see themselves set to the music of the movie, how does it elevate the emotional response that they had to the work they did? And I remember Hanks was talking about the Apollo 13 score. I think James Horner did that. And it was about, like, he didn't want to see the movie until it was done. And the score just kind of, like, you know, it just changes everything. The music in this film, the way Zendaya called it, was house music.
Yeah, that's perfect.
And so one of the things I found interesting about her answer was she's the producer on the film. So she said she went into the edit and saw the film without the music first, without the Reznor Ross score. And what's interesting about the movie, and I'm sure, Gabe, you agree, I think the film is written and directed and edited like a tennis match. The entire story is designed that way. Mm-hmm. So the way Zendaya put it, which I think is brilliant, is the tennis match is not just on the court. It's happening between the dialogue.
Yeah.
So when the score hits, to Gabe's point, it's supposed, at least in her opinion, and at least the way I just perceived it, it's supposed to become a tennis match of dialogue. And so if you watch every scene that that score is in, they're basically passing the metaphorical ball back and forth. Mm-hmm. And it's just boom, 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 boom. And like, there's like a scene in a sauna, which is in the trailer as well, where the music just pumps. And it's not music you would normally hear in a scene like that. But as the scene progresses and becomes more and more intense, the music then cues up a match, a literal tennis match, metaphorically, in that moment.
Even goes as far as the metaphor of a tennis match, the mechanics of a tennis match, and even what the characters, kind of how they describe like a tennis match as a relationship, is reflected in, as I was saying, the structure of the film, where you're literally, your emotions as the audience are pushed and pulled from side to side of each player in this match.
Yes.
And they reveal something, you go, oh shit, they did that, or that's how they know each other, or this is what happened before that. Well, now I'm over here. And then something else happens, you go, okay, but now I'm over here. And and whether it's like, you know, whose side you're on in a certain part of the story, or just kind of your understanding shifting with your sort of being able to relate to one character or the other, even that shifts like a ball across the court. It is, like I said, exquisite is the word I keep using for the way this movie is structured.
To Gabe's point about the structure of the film, there's this one linear match that's taking you throughout the whole film. And I was talking to Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist about this. They got to shoot that match in story linear order. So as the film progresses, you're watching this match essentially. And what Gabe is pointing out brilliantly is the way it bounces back and forth in time. Like, I feel like Nolan would watch this movie and go, oh my gosh, this is insane. Because like the way he deals with time in this, what's really cool about this is the guy who wrote this, Justin, I don't want to botch his last name, is married to Celine Song, who wrote Past and directed Past Lives. And so both films are about love triangles. And so the it's just interesting how a love triangle can narratively drive a story. The Reznor Ross score to me is the best, my favorite score of theirs in Social Network. There's an atmosphere to it. There is it just amps the film up in a way. And I can't even imagine, like Gabe, imagine Zendaya in that edit suite.
It does.
Watching without the music.
I can't picture it. There's film scores that are subtle and they're really just meant to sort of give you this underlying feeling and sort of change your tone. And then there's almost like a music video. Mm-hmm. It sets the pace of the movie without having to adjust the speed of the edit, if that makes sense. Like it intensifies a scene almost like, and it, you know, it's kind of a house music-y kind of vibe. Like, you know, those scenes in Drive, Sean?
Yes.
Where like, it's kind of a sullen, slow moment. And then the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do hits and you're like, oh, shit's about to, like, someone's about to die. Something's about to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, it uses its score like that. That is just really makes your heart race. It's really great.
Where does it rank? You move with it.
In terms of like a Zendaya performance.
So I'm glad you asked that question. I think she's amazing in it. To me, I mean, I think Euphoria and this might be my favorite thing she's ever done. This might be my favorite movie she's ever made.
Yeah.
What's cool about this film is like, she is like, and I won't go into spoilers, but when during a tennis match, at least from the movie, I don't play tennis, so I could be wrong on this. There's a person that sits up in that chair and kind of navigates the match. Well, I don't know the name of that person.
Like a line judge. I think those aren't line judges. Those are like umpire type thing.
All called umpires?
Kind of.
I think so.
But the person calls out the plays. Like if someone does something wrong or they'll fault them.
Yeah.
Right.
They're just kind of the ref of a tennis match.
Which is basically what her character is to the movie, in my opinion.
It's funny. I forget who it was. I was sitting with someone when we were watching. Oh, it was Jessica who's one of the editors on the site. And I think she plays tennis and her husband plays tennis.
They play a lot of tennis.
And she was like, I'm curious about it because of tennis. She's like, but I heard that Luca doesn't really give a shit about tennis. She's like, so I'm curious. And it's funny because it's a tennis movie, but it's not really there to make you excited about tennis, but you kind of romantically love tennis after this, because there's a line where Zendaya's character talks about a tennis match is a relationship. And she talks about the back and forth and it's a conversation. And she says for about 15 seconds, we're playing tennis, but it's this pure moment. And I think I've said this a lot on the show lately. It's this great moment where you're like, wow, that is the metaphor of the whole movie, of the way these characters are structured, the way the stories are structured.
Yeah.
And the way the players are put in place, players in the story are put in place are exactly like a tennis match. And it's just really cool when you're able to play with structure in that way.
It's almost as if like the dialogue scenes are almost more intense tennis matches than the actual matches themselves, which is pretty wild, but they all feed into the narrative of those matches. But also like one thing I would want to point out, talk about Zendaya, who's absolutely amazing. I really think this is Josh O'Connor's movie.
He is
like, there amazing. Is something about, I mean, Gabe, back me up on this. It's all in his smirk and smile.
The smile is amazing.
There's like this, like, cause it's like a slow thing. It's like
all three of them are giving top notch performances.
Amazing.
But I'm happy to see all three of them in an Oscar race, because I think they're all incredibly nuanced. And because the story changes the way it does, their performances sort of have to subtly shift from scene to scene, or at least give you the chance to perceive it differently, you know, with the information you're given. And I think that it does such a good job of showcasing their performances across the entire film.
Also, there is a split diopter in this movie that I think is one of the greatest shots I've seen in years. I won't spoil where it is. It is towards the end, but it's a, like, to me, the best thing a filmmaker can do is do a shot that might look cool, but it's done completely for a narrative.
The split
reason.
Diopter for me is almost 100% distracting and not worth it almost all the time.
Even
in like All the President's Men, which I know is like the very famous split dot, for me it's almost like
or Blowout.
It's just like, gets a little too okay. I'm watching a movie in my.
But
you know.
in the way it's used here is it's character driven because it's the like to me the split diopter in this movie is the entire movie. It's the shot itself is literally the thematic drama of what the movie is trying to portray.
Would you want to have Sean dip out for just like a minute? Do you want to talk spoilers or do you feel like we've covered enough?
I'm trying to think because like
I'm more curious. I just want to ask you about the ending.
Okay.
I feel like that might be worth having on the dip.
I'll throw it to a break
after we're done and get you back.
Okay. Sounds good.
Cool. Okay. So yeah, spoiler warning. If you have not seen the film and you listen to all of that, you absolutely need to see this film. So dip out now. Right. I'll set it up slightly and Kevin, you can give some more context if you think it needs it. What I'm really curious is I want to know your thoughts about how the end of it. And I'll say it this way. For me, I spent the last half of the movie I was invested in the movie, but I kept going like, how is this going to end? Because everything kept shifting, kept changing. My allegiances within the story kept changing to where it starts to build. And you're like, I'm not for or against anybody. This is just kind of brilliant and complex. And I ended up feeling like I just want there to be a happy ending. Yeah. And I'm like, that's fucking impossible. How do you make a happy ending? And I think this achieves a happy ending.
Oh,
like
it's
vague.
Perfect.
It's vague. It leaves room to think about, to ask certain questions. And I think Jake and I forget who had seen it yet. I think maybe it was only Jake and I had seen it at first. And he texted me, he's like, who do you think won? So my first question to you is, who do you think won? I think it gives a clear answer, but it does leave it sort of up to interpretation.
What's fascinating is I didn't care to know.
Exactly. I think that is important. I think that's what the movie's trying to say. Not, ooh, who do you think won? I think it's trying to say that's not the important thing that happened.
And if I'm being honest, I don't know that I have an opinion because I was so there's a whole arc in this movie about a bit of whether or not, you know, someone slept with somebody.
Right.
And that comes full circle at the end. And to me, that was the climax, literally, no pun intended. Like that was the climax moment. So the actual ending shot, I'm less interested. I mean, at the end of the day, like. You know, also, I would argue based on the ending that there would be what do you call it when someone messes up in tennis? You have to give them a ticket or a fault or something like that, because you can't jump over the net like that.
I think he like fell over the net. I think.
Right.
I
don't know. Would he get slided for it, though? You know,
I guess I don't know. But again, I think the movie doesn't really care about tennis.
And I don't. Like, interesting. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So
what happens?
One thing that I love, we talk about the smirk.
Oh my gosh.
I love the way that final scene culminates. Ugh. And like I said,
and the cinematography, you're on the ball. It's like, what the hell?
But I love that it pays off and reflects that moment where she talks about for 15 seconds, we're playing tennis.
Yep.
And I love that this whole movie, we realize this tennis match that we started that we thought was like, oh, it's a hotshot tennis guy versus an up and comer. And it's going to be a fun competitive thing. And then you learn about all this history and you get to that moment and you now know everything, and you know that he's married to her and they've slept together and she's the back and forth, but you know how it started and you know their competitive nature and sort of the casual nature of things. And the fact that he does the move, which is brilliant, to say like, I slept with your wife.
Also, then, do you think it's his kid?
Well, I don't think hang on. Let me finish. Let's start with the scene. We can answer those questions. I don't know as much, but I love that scene, he has that emotional moment and then they go to that serve. And he like hits it and faults so that it's like, okay, game mat or set point or whatever. However he does it.
Love or something, yeah.
And then they're playing tennis. And I love that it culminates in this moment where everyone knows everything. And this match meant so many things to his career, to him beating him personally. And now that everything's out of the way, they're all three of them, their one true love is tennis. And in that moment, they're like, they're allowed to sort of settle things without saying, and they go, let's play tennis. And they play that last. And to me, it feels like they're both really trying to win. And now this means something. And it's not, I'm letting up for her or for you or whatever. And I love the way that ended because it told me that one, I think that art wins, which I think is whatever. Mm. But I love the happy moment of it was settled. They played tennis and him sort of catching him and embracing him versus trying to make the play, I think is all you need to know of. This is a complex, complicated thing, but there's their relationship means so much, the two men, and their relationship with her is interesting and striking and means different things to each of them, but they find each other again, the two friends in the end, which I think is, again, the happy ending I wanted that I couldn't see coming. And it's just, you can't beat it when a movie surprises you with exactly what you wanted.
Well, it's kind of like the ending, in my opinion, like these bittersweet open-end endings. Like, I remember one of my favorite ones ever was La La Land because it was happy and sad at the same time. They both got what they wanted, but they really didn't get each other.
Sure.
And not that it's ambiguous, but I kind of like things like that. I like that it's more real life rather than tied up in a nice bow. But the reason I asked the question about the kid thing is because early in the film, if I remember correctly, Josh and her do sleep together at an earlier point while she's with Art.
In Atlanta, the Atlanta thing?
Right. And remember, he goes down to see there and they're at the table and then they leave.
The fact that they reveal that later, that he saw them together and then they were gone is like, so he's probably been either in denial or been, like it changes the context of everything because
everything
they're doing it behind his back and there's this treachery, or there's this betrayal and stuff, but also it's so complex and he kind of understands what's happening that it's just so interesting.
I am going to blow your mind. I could be wrong. Go ahead. And I didn't time it. But could you imagine if that last moment of play is actually only 15 seconds?
There's no way it is. Because it feels like it's drawn out. But maybe, I'm talking about
the game point. No, I'm talking about the game point.
The game point?
The literal last moment. From the serve, is that 15 seconds? Because if that's 15 seconds, that might be one of the coolest. I don't know.
They just did different takes where she's like 16 seconds for 17 seconds for 12 seconds.
Could you imagine? She has like ADR 29 seconds, right? Yeah, we'll ADR this later. But no, but I wonder now. Yeah,
go ahead. Did you have one last? I was going to ask if you had any final things before we wrap up.
I said this at the beginning of the episode. This younger generation of actors are so fascinated by filmmaking process. I think Zendaya is going to direct one day. I think Denis Villeneuve told Spielberg that she's going to be a director. She's obsessed with cinematography. She's obsessed with the process of making movies. What I love about this film is it's made with such passion from people who actually care about this actual process. Mm-hmm. And it's shot on film. It's unique in its own tone, but I just really, really love Zendaya as somebody in this business right now. She's an incredible actor, but also just a brilliant person behind the scenes. And there's just something about her that I haven't seen in a lot of movie stars in a long time. The Austin Butlers and Chalamet's in that same field, in my opinion. They're all amazing. And I just love that we get to see younger talent bringing back that old school style of filmmaking in a way. Like, I haven't seen Bike Riders yet, but that looks like an Easy Rider type of movie. And so there's a lot of things that I'm just fascinated by. So now it's like I am so in tune with what Zendaya is doing because she's so curious about the process. And so I just wanted to shout her out because she's one of the most remarkable talent in the industry right now from an acting perspective, producing perspective. I just really, really admire her. I very much admire her.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I haven't seen Euphoria, but I'm with you in that this is my favorite performance from her. All right. With that note, we will no longer talk spoilers about challenges, but we will throw it to a quick break. And on the other side, we'll pick Sean back up. I think we're going to talk Deadpool trailer and we'll try to squeeze in a little bit of a game. But we'll get things moving on the other side.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we are back. Okay, so earlier this week, a trailer for an extremely anticipated movie, Deadpool and Wolverine, dropped. We've been talking about it incessantly in the text thread. Figured we'd bring some of that conversation to light on the show. Kev, you have put a lot of weight on this movie as the film that's going to get you back invested in the MCU. Did this trailer solidify that belief at all?
100%. And I mean, and we were discussing this, we were discussing the summer movie preview of things like, or, and just in general, like I, like a lot of people, I believe are fatigued with Marvel at the moment. And a lot of the television shows didn't connect with me too much exposition. I did like the first season of Loki. I've not admittedly not seen the second season of Loki fully. But I think what this all comes down to me is passion. This is something, the first time I ever interviewed Ryan Reynolds for a first for Deadpool 1, we were throwing darts at Wolverine's face because Ryan has wanted this for so long. And to finally be able to achieve that dream, not only within the Deadpool world, but then to bring this over to the MCU and now be able to operate within the MCU world, make the first R-rated MCU movie ever. It's remarable to me. It brings me joy to know that someone was so passionate about something for so long, getting Hugh Jackman back into that suit, putting the classic yellow suit on, and giving fans a Wolverine what it seems like we haven't seen yet is amazing to me. Also, we saw all the set photos for this, and we can saw the trailer. A lot of this seems location shot, you know, and so yeah. a lot of the Marvel films recently have been so CG heavy. I mean, Quantumania, I don't know. I don't know if a single scene of that was shot on location. I have no idea. I mean, I don't want to fault it. I'm sure there were some scenes, but at least in the Deadpool Wolverine trailer that came out this week, it looks like a lot of locations.
Filmed in London. I mean, it was filmed primarily in London.
I mean, we kept seeing those like behind the scenes photos of them out in like the desert type of thing with the 20th Century Fox logo or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I think this trailer is brilliant. The line you opened our show with was my favorite moment in the trailer, because what I love about Deadpool so much is the banter now that he has with Wolverine, because Wolverine Logan, this Logan that we're seeing, is obviously a very angry character. And for Deadpool to quote unquote being annoying him is just funny to me. It's like that whole banter. But if you watch closely in that moment in the beginning, like Ryan Deadpool slides and he goes, "Hi, Peanut," and like, and he's obviously already angry, Wolverine or Logan. But what's fascinating about that scene is Ryan goes from super playful Deadpool into immediate like dark Deadpool, because if you actually hear the tone of his voice change from the "Hi, Peanut" to "You're going to be breathing through your effing forehead," like it's like that to me is such a tonal shift, and I just feel like, I don't know, I'm very interested because these are both tragic characters in a way. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated to see kind of how they're going to play off of each other and how they might need each other. Also, just watching Hugh Jackman and Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool and Wolverine jumping through one of the portals. Yeah. And just, it sounds like Ryan's going, "Yeah!" It's the like, stances, that to me is...
The stances so that they make in the cool. jump are even character reflective.
Oh,
like Deadpool's got his legs tucked up underneath him. Yeah. Like he's having a blast. That I want to point out that Hugh Jackman is 55 years old.
Yeah.
And has been playing this character for 24 years. And he looks arguably younger
the best
now.
He's ever looked.
He's officially changing his name. Officially changing his name to Hugh Jacked Man.
Yeah, just,
dude. He looks there's a scene permanently jacked.
There's insane. A shot where Deadpool and Wolverine are walking out on some kind of street. I don't know if you see behind it. It says Liefeld. Yeah. Do you see Liefeld behind it? Which is
Liefeld's
the creator
only
of Deadpool.
Feet. Which is really funny.
Which is funny, yeah.
And I think Liefeld posted a picture on his Twitter the other day of like just his feet or something like that. Which I thought was funny.
Because if you don't know, he famously doesn't. I don't know if he does now or didn't draw feet.
He draws weird triangular feet. Right. Or it gets criticized for the way he draws feet, so he crops them off at the leg, essentially. So,
but also, so the shot I'm referring to is like it's Deadpool and Wolverine walking in slow motion as they're rounding a corner.
Right, it's the sleeveless.
Right, but the size of Jackman's arms, you can even from a far away shot, you can see the veins popping out of his arms. He looks
crazy,
disturbingly big, and it's like, and I think it's just fascinating me to because like you're right, This to me is the best looking Wolverine I've ever seen on screen.
Well, and finally in the costume too, for God's sakes. I mean, been waiting for years to see the costume. We still don't see the mask on him yet, so.
I don't know a ton about the villain, I have not read into a lot of that, but there's a shot in the trailer where the villain is manipulating Wolverine and like he's throwing his like arms down. That stuff looks so cool. But also like the violence, like the violence in these movies, the violence from a Deadpool perspective, he has to tonally shift between fun violence and brutal violence. But when he's like blowing the guns into like Wolverine's like stomach, and it's like, I just can't wait to see this. It looks like it's shot really well, but also again, it's the location thing. So much of it feels real.
Do you remember in part two where Juggernaut rips Wolverine, Deadpool in half?
Literally rips
him in half. I mean, these are not non-gory films.
I think you're right that I think a lot of people are putting weight on this to give them something for the MCU. Yeah. And I think that, you know, we call it Marvel fatigue. I think that there's a debate of whether it's fatigue or it's just uninteresting things are being presented and therefore people are uninterested. I think there's a difference there. A technical difference for you from what you saw. And I don't know how much you kind of went shot by shot to maybe break it down. Was there anything to you that you saw? And I think I saw you mention at one point that, you know, obviously with these trailers, things could be different than what they are versus, you know, as far as like props or sets so that they don't give too much away in the trailer. Was there anything that you saw that you went, okay, this is something this movie's going to do that I think is promising or ties to the existing MCU in a way that you're excited to see outside of the obvious, well, you know, I guess TVA thing.
There's a couple of things that I need answered that I'm wondering how this movie is going to handle it all. I wrote a piece on Cinema Blend about the 20th Century Fox logo that's decimated in the background. And the presence of the cloud looking creature, Eliath, which for people who watch Loki knows that Eliath lives in this void at the end of time where things have just been dumped. Essentially, when things get pruned by the TVA, they end up in this void at the end of time. It's kind of like a dumping ground for trash kind of thing. I think that void where Deadpool is fighting Wolverine is going to be the void at the end of the quote unquote 20th Century Fox studio timeline. And so, you know, where we saw like ships and things in the background, I think that there is eventually going to be populated by like 20th Century Fox type stuff. Because if you go through the trailer too, the villain's name is Cassandra Nova. People can read about her in the comics. I won't give away what her twist is here. There are like villains from the previous X-Men films that could be spotted throughout the trailer. And so I think that this movie is going to try to button up the existing Fox universe of mutant movies so that moving forward, the MCU will be able to do a new X-Men. And this will give closure to the way that the universe plays out. I think that this might mean, because some people are already jumping ahead to speculation about, since Avengers Secret Wars has been announced, And we have now seen Tobey Maguire back in a Spider-Man suit and Hugh Jackman back in a Wolverine costume, that they will be featured in Secret Wars. Like, this might not be the end of Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. He could at least stick around for one more film, which is this. If Avengers Secret Wars tries to double up on Endgame, it would feature like every Marvel character that's ever been played by somebody over the course of time, kind of thing. Ambitious. I'm not quite sure they can pull it off. But, you know, to this point, we've already seen a number of existing Marvel characters popping up in other things. So we'll see. I want to bring up an interesting wrinkle. And again, we can only sort of apply these through our own personal filters. But I sent PJ, who is a rabid Marvel fan and has watched every MCU movie up to this point, I sent him the Deadpool trailer. And he said, I haven't seen Deadpool 1 and 2.
Interesting.
Which is because they are non-MCU movies.
Younger. He's also he's younger.
Well, so he's
Deadpool
20 now.
1 came out, but Deadpool 1 came out when he was 12.
He was too young to see those movies when they came out, but he hasn't been compelled to check them out leading into this. And I
they're not
so
MCU
I do
movies.
Wonder exactly. They haven't been MCU movies up until this point. So he's one example, but it makes me wonder how many other people out there
when you point out, though, I think this movie has a lot of pressure on it. I think Marvel probably internally has a lot of expectation for this movie. I think that fans in general have a lot of expectation, but I do think it's unfair to expect it to completely reset our understanding of the MCU or what the MCU is. I think that's a huge ask. And I think what the MCU is different to a lot of people. And so it's hard to even define that in a movie. And
I mean, reset in terms of expectations.
I want to say that was also expected of The Flash. And I think that there's a parallel there that we should maybe I think it's always good to sort of hold expectations back. But I think instead of ask this movie to solve whatever problem you have with the MCU, you being you
I like
Kevin,
The Flash.
Me, again, but my point is the resetting that universe is not a thing.
Here's what I'd like it to reset.
Is it's asking
the quality, the bar of quality. Just make
exactly.
a good movie.
That's what I'm talking
exactly.
about. Just make I'm a talking good quality. Movie. I'm not even really talking about story. Oh, yeah. I want
to
clarify
get back
that.
To the grade quality. A stamp yes. on a Marvel yes. movie. Like when a Marvel movie comes out, it should be superior. Make it entertaining. That's it.
Didn't Liefeld, I don't want to misquote him. I think Liefeld tweeted out that this has the best action in the MCU since Civil War.
I mean, he's a little biased, though. Liefeld's always kind of Deadpool.
Since Winter Soldier, he said. Yeah. And even that's,
I'm sorry. Winter Soldier.
Even that's not fair. I think that's unfair.
I actually do think that Winter Soldier still has the best action in the MCU. The grounded nature of those street fights and those scenes and like the bridge sequence. I mean, listen, I love Infinity War
sequences.
It's a Jason Bourne movie starring Steve Rogers. You're right.
It's dude. The scene with Nick Fury when that bomb goes under his car. That whole sequence is so remarkable.
But watch the Wakanda fight in Infinity War.
There's
like,
a lot
Wakanda
of great.
Fight in
I love
there's
it. A lot of great.
The, Black, David like the first Black Panther had
David
great
Leitch,
stuff.
Okay,
didn't David Leitch only, do Infinity War?
Oh, I don't know.
Sam Hargrave was second unit director on the
Thor's Arrival.
What was the last one that Leitch did? Leitch did some MCU stuff. I thought he was in the mix
too.
For. No. I mean, like while he was still doing stunt work, stunt coordination. I think he was involved in Infinity War.
Even Shang-Chi has really good action, too. I get what Liefeld's saying. But
I will say this, though. I think what Liefeld means is grounded, real action. So, like, for example, the Wakanda fight is amazing, but you're dealing with actual superheroes. Not that Deadpool and Wolverine are not superheroes, but there's something. I think the point is Winter Soldier, the fighting in Winter Soldier is more grounded in a reality than it doesn't feel. It's almost like The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight is a superhero movie, but the fighting and the action feels like it's grounded in a reality. The Wakanda fight in Infinity War is brilliant, but that's clearly superhero fantasy and in a way. But emotionally, you are. I mean, listen, I think Infinity War and Winter Soldier are leveled to me. They're both the same quality. I think they're both the best films in the MCU so far. I just want to see more action like that. That's what I'm saying.
To clarify, Civil War was David Leitch did second unit. That was his last Marvel second unit sort of stunt focused.
David Leitch. Hashtag if it happens.
Hashtag if it happens.
Let's put that out there. Okay, let's finish out this week's episode with a very quick game Gabe wants to introduce. He's even cooked up a little name for it. He's calling it Lost in Translation. Gabe, what are we playing?
So this is kind of fun. This is one that sort of occurred to me naturally, where I saw the director of Immaculate, friend of the show, fan of the show, discussing it. And then I had this conversation with my dad about international movie titles and how for international markets, movies that are, you know, either produced in America or at least released in America, their titles are changed for different markets because culturally they have different meanings. But I think also often they're changed, and then when they're translated again back into English, it can be wildly entertaining. Sometimes they're on the nose and sometimes they are so vastly different. I thought that it would be fun to make a little game out of it. So what we'll do here is I will offer you the international title of a well-known film, and you guys will have to try to deduce what film that is actually based on, or what that film is actually.
Okay. I love this.
Makes sense? Everyone game? I think the way I'll do this is I'll give it, and then you'll each just let me, like, once you'll each have a guess, and then I'll let you guess. If no one gives it, no one gets it, I'll get one more round of guess for each of you.
Okay.
And then I'll reveal at that point. I think that'll work best. And I suppose I can keep score because I know you boys are nice and competitive.
Yes. We do like coming out on top, especially with Jake being out too. Gives us a chance.
I'll just give a point for a correct answer. To start out, this is the one that kind of inspired this game. My father is Hungarian. This is the Hungarian title for this particular movie. If you boys are ready, I will present to you film titled in Hungary, The Eighth Passenger, Death.
Okay, which I do have a question.
Great. Go ahead.
Does the title that we're trying to get to also have a colon in it?
That does not matter. So these are just completely changed titles. Like sometimes they take, it'll be one thing. It'll make more sense probably after you get this first one. It'll be one thing, it's not just the words translated. It's this movie is this, and then when they release it, they call it something else in another country.
Is it Bullet Train?
Kevin guesses Bullet Train. Sean, your guess?
The Hateful Eight.
Incorrect. I'll give you each.
I was confident.
One more guess for The Eighth Passenger.
Death. Okay. Snowpiercer.
Okay. And Sean, your second guess?
Throw Mama from the Train.
Incorrect. The correct answer, brilliantly, is Alien. The eighth, because there's seven passengers.
Come on.
The eighth passenger is dead.
How would we ever get that? That's absolutely insane.
This is why this is fun. It's
pretty great. That's really great. Pretty great.
And it makes sense.
The Hateful Eight was pretty, that was a good guess.
I actually thought Sean was gonna got it. There was no question that he got it. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, our next title is Happiness Therapy.
Marriage Story?
Kevin has Marriage Story. Sean?
It's a pretty good one. Analyze This.
Nice. Incorrect. I'll give you guys another round of guess. Maybe we'll do three. Happiness Therapy. We'll do three. Three sounds more fun.
Happiness Therapy.
Okay. Can we have a hint? Is this a classic movie?
No.
Okay. Is it modern or older?
Modern. I would have assumed was class. What classic. You mean by classic?
No, I think I meant classic more like, is it a famous classic?
I mean, these are all well known. I'm not giving you
Not the Sopranos.
It is not the Sopranos. Kev, do you have one more guess?
Happiness Therapy. Well, it can't be a TV show, right?
True. Yeah.
Some of these are so fun.
Is it Patch Adams?
Okay, so Sean has three guesses. Kevin, do you have one more guess?
Bo is Afraid?
No. Happiness Therapy is the French title for Silver Linings Playbook.
What? Come on.
That's crazy. Okay.
What?
All right, we're nice and warm. We see kind of right, where these can go.
We're being too logical about this. It's not...
You'll see.
You gotta really...
Well, then there's examples like this. What film? And again, I'll let you let me know when you're locked in versus saying it, because I want to get you both the chance to get it.
Okay.
Get it right.
Okay.
This film is titled Grandpa Carl's Flying House.
Up.
Kevin, let everyone lock in. Up. Yes. Sean, is that your guess as well? Okay.
That's my guess as well, too.
Up is correct. You both get a point.
Okay.
Grandpa Carl's Flying House, which is the beginning of that movie.
Yes.
So on the news.
Imagine if you take your kid to see Grandpa Carl's Flying House and it begins with a montage about his wife dying.
Love that. Yeah.
That title's more on the nose, though, than
anything
else.
It goes back and forth. This is a fun game. That is the title in Japan. Again, and this, like I said, there's somewhere they've completely changed the title, and then I think there's somewhere they've changed the title, and then it getting translated back into English also provides a bit of
comedy. Where are you finding these?
Shout out to Screen Crush, Reader's Digest. I saw some people mentioning them on Reddit. I tried to find some different sources to find different things, but I kind of went with more. These are, I think, more of the baseline, more well-known, interesting, funny titles. But if we like this and we play it again, I can, try to find some deeper cuts. Our next title is Vaseline. Vaseline.
Slither?
Good guess.
Kevin guesses Slither.
James Gunn's Slither.
Sean, do you have a guess for Vaseline?
Oh my God, I have no idea.
this is another one that's fun once you see it.
My mind is kind of like racing through a million things that it could be. Joy by Jennifer Lawrence.
Nice. Incorrect. Do you guys have one more guess? Do you want to try another one for Vaseline? You feel like sounds like you guys are way off.
I feel this like is I the, my mind went to Stone Temple Pilots, but it's a band.
I like the idea of having hints for this. Maybe the next time I make this game, Vaseline. I'll also provide some hints.
Okay. Is Vaseline speaking to like a healing aspect of the story?
No, that's a very specific question. I will say this. Vaseline is directly in reference to the title itself.
What? What?
This is the title of this particular film in Mexico. I can give you that hint. I think we have time for a couple more.
Venom?
Vaseline is the title for Greece. Greece in Mexico. Let's do one more and then we will say bye to Kevin and Sean and myself. I have to give you this one. It is called Wild Speed : Mega Max.
Oh, Mad Max Fury Road.
Incorrect.
What?
Incorrect. This is the title of this film in Japan.
Say it one more time.
Wild Speed : Mega Max.
Speed Racer.
Incorrect. This is the Japanese title for
Speed
Fast 2? 5. For Fast 5.
That's funny.
What?
I have more of these. We'll play some more when we have time, but Kevin has to get to a junket, so we will
he
call
does.
It there, Sean, all if right. You can take us out.
We will wrap up. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into this week's show. As a call out, are you seeing Challengers? If so, let us know what has interested you in going to the theaters specifically for this film. If you have seen it, drop us a review in the comments down below. In the meantime, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show, of course, is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys with a brand new episode next week. And until then,
Christopher Nolan horror movie,
George Miller.
Like it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.